Imagine for a moment a situation. Police officers arrive, not just to arrest someone for a crime, but to seize their property, a car, maybe a house, or even the actual money in their bank account.
Right.
And here's the kicker. They might not even have been convicted of a crime yet. How does that even happen? And, you know, where does that property go once it's taken?
Yeah.
It's a powerful and, frankly, often perplexing situation that many people just don't fully grasp.
It truly is. This taps into a legal tool that is, well, incredibly potent and, like you said, can be applied even before a criminal conviction.
Mm-hmm.
It's a facet of law enforcement that, while it's aimed at justice, holds really profound implications for individuals and, you know, their assets.
Absolutely. Welcome to the Deep Dive, where today we're going to unpack the intricacies of asset forfeiture.
Mm.
This isn't some, like, obscure legal curiosity. It's a process with real, tangible effects on people's lives and communities right across the country.
Definitely.
Our mission for you today is to guide you through the complexities of asset forfeiture, and we're using the very training materials that peace officers themselves use.
That's right.
We're going to explore its underlying philosophy, the precise legal frameworks that govern it, how it's actually executed on the ground, and importantly, what happens to the seized assets.
And our goal is really to give you a shortcut to being genuinely well-informed on this topic.
Right.
You'll gain a clear understanding of this complex subject, hopefully filled with some surprising details and real-world examples that make the legal jargon a bit more accessible, more engaging.
Yeah, cut through the noise.
We want you to grasp not just the what, but the fundamental why behind these powerful actions, letting you really teach yourself the core concepts.
So with that powerful opening scenario in mind, let's really delve into the core of asset forfeiture. When property is taken by the state like this, is it considered, like, extra punishment for a crime? Or is there a different philosophy driving these actions entirely?
That's a great question. And what's truly fascinating here is the core philosophy that guides asset forfeiture. It's fundamentally viewed as remedial rather than punitive.
Remedial, yeah.
The main goal isn't to inflict additional punishment on a person. Instead, the whole idea is to deprive criminals of the profits they've made from their illegal activities.
Uh-huh.
And the instrumentalities, essentially, the tools or property they use to commit those crimes. Think of it as kind of hitting the reset button on ill-gotten gains. It's about taking the profit motive directly out of crime, making it far less attractive as, you know, a venture.
So it's less about adding to the jail sentence and more about hitting the criminal enterprise where it hurts most, its financial backbone. That distinction seems really crucial.
It is, and for several reasons. This philosophical difference is why, for example, the burden of proof is generally lower in a civil forfeiture case than in a criminal one. It's about the property's connection to the crime, not necessarily proving a person's guilt beyond a shadow of a doubt. The intention, at least stated intention, is explicitly not to be a means of oppression, and the process must always strive to seek justice.
Okay.
And crucially, there are checks in place, like the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause.
Mm-hmm.
This means that the amount of property seized must bear some reasonable relationship to the gravity of the underlying offense. You know, you can't seize a multi-million dollar mansion for a petty misdemeanor.
Right. That would be excessive.
Exactly. Yeah. Unless, of course, that mansion was clearly bought with proceeds from a much larger, more serious criminal enterprise.
Mm.
Proportionality is absolutely key.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. So the punishment should fit the crime, even when we're talking about property. But what about the jeopardy aspect? You know, double jeopardy. If someone is facing criminal charges related to the property, does the forfeiture case have to wait? Or can they run at the same time?
This is a critical point that often surprises people.
Mm.
The filing of a criminal offense is actually not necessary for asset forfeiture to proceed.
Really?
Yes. A civil forfeiture case can move forward independently, and, well, it often does.
Mm-hmm.
However, and this is important, if a not guilty verdict is reached in a related criminal case, or if the criminal charges are dismissed,
mm-hmm.
that does affect the property in the civil forfeiture proceeding. It creates a strong legal presumption that the property should not be forfeited.
A presumption, okay, not automatic.
Right. It's not an absolute automatic bar in every single circumstance, but it significantly weakens the state's position and makes forfeiture much, much harder to achieve.
Okay. So what exactly are we talking about when we say property in the context of asset forfeiture? What kind of assets are actually eligible for this? Is it just like cash or drugs, or is it much broader?
To really get this, we need to be precise with the definitions, especially contraband and proceeds, as they're laid out in state law specifically, Article 59.01 of the Code of Criminal Procedure, or CCP 59.01.
CCP 59.01, got it.
These terms aren't just legal jargon. They're really the foundational categories of what can be seized. So when we talk about contraband, we're referring to property of any nature.
Any nature?
Any nature. Real estate, like a house, personal items like a car or jewelry, tangible goods, electronics, or even intangible assets like intellectual property rights or, increasingly, digital currency.
Wow.
The key is that this property is used in the commission of specific criminal offenses.
So it's not just the illegal items themselves, like the drugs, but anything that helped the crime happen. That covers a huge range.
Precisely. And the list of offenses that qualify is, well, it's quite extensive. Contraband basically covers property directly involved in a wide array of serious felonies.
Like what?
Well, you've got major crimes like robbery, burglary, theft, fraud, computer crimes, telecommunications fraud. It also broadly includes offenses related to organized crime, human trafficking, evading arrest.
Right.
And, as you'd expect, any felonies under the Texas Controlled Substances Act or relating to dangerous drugs.
Right. The drug connection is obvious.
It is. But even some serious misdemeanors can trigger forfeiture if the defendant has prior convictions for similar offenses. The scope is incredibly broad, really designed to capture nearly any serious criminal activity where property is used as a tool or facilitator.
So a car used to transport drugs would definitely be contraband because it's an instrumentality of the crime?
Exactly.
But what about the money gained from selling those drugs? Is that still contraband, or does it have a different name? The fruits of the crime?
That's where the distinction between proceeds and instrumentalities becomes crucial. Is the property gained from the commission of the offense? That's proceeds.
Okay.
Or is it used to facilitate the commission of the offense? That would be an instrumentality, which is a type of contraband.
Ah.
Like both can be seized, but the legal pathway to defining them and, you know, the arguments in court might differ slightly.
Got it. So proceeds are the direct financial fruits of the crime. How is proceeds specifically defined then? Does it include anything surprising that goes beyond just cash?
It definitely does, and this is where it gets really interesting and maybe a bit surprising for a lot of listeners. Under CCP Article 59.017, proceeds is defined first as money or property gained from an event or transaction during the commission of a listed felony or misdemeanor or from a crime of violence.
Makes sense.
It also includes property acquired with proceeds gained from such commission. So, for example, if you sell drugs and then use that illicit money to buy, say, a luxury car.
Right.
The car itself is considered proceeds, even though it's not cash.
Okay, that seems straightforward enough. But you hinted at surprising details. What could be more surprising than seizing a car bought with drug money?
Well, get this. Here's where the law casts an incredibly wide net. The definition of proceeds also includes income. A person accused or convicted of a crime receives from things like movies, books, magazine articles, or any form of media, including internet websites or live entertainment in which the crime was reenacted.
Wait, hold on. So if a convicted criminal writes a book about their crime, the income from that book, even if it's just their personal story, could be seized as proceeds.
That's exactly right.
That's truly fascinating and a very direct attempt to remove all financial incentive from crime.
Exactly. The legal thinking here is to ensure criminals cannot profit in any way from their illegal acts, directly or indirectly. It aims to eliminate all economic incentives connected to criminal notoriety, closing potential loopholes.
Wow.
And it gets even more surprising. It also includes the sale of tangible property whose value is increased by the notoriety gained from the conviction of an offense.
So, like, if a murderer's car becomes infamous and suddenly worth more because of the crime.
Precisely. Imagine a piece of art or a personal item that becomes famous because it was connected to a notorious crime. That increased value, the part driven by notoriety, can be considered proceeds subject to forfeiture. It's a very broad and comprehensive definition. It's also important to note that the commonly understood meaning prevails in defining proceeds. And critically, conviction of a criminal offense is not necessary to define proceeds for forfeiture.
Still not necessary, even for proceeds.
Correct. The property's illicit origin is enough for the civil case.
Okay, to bring these definitions to life, let's consider Mr. and Mrs. Benavidez and their mom-and-pop grocery store smiling face. They get approached by a man they only know as Cinco.
Mm-hmm.
Every Monday for the last year, Cinco asks them to accept checks for merchandise, but to tell the person writing the check to leave the pay-to portion blank.
Okay, red flag right there.
Big time. Cinco says they'll use a store stamp later when they deposit it. Problem is, they don't have a store stamp.
Oof.
For doing this, Cinco pays them a 20% cash bonus on the total value of the checks, averaging about $500 a week. They think it's suspicious, sure, but they see the extra money as a bonus, maybe for their hard work, and since it's cash, they figure, well, no harm, no record.
Risky assumption.
Very. This bonus allows them to buy a brand new SUV. Then, boom, Cinco is arrested for money laundering, and the investigation leads right to the Benavidezes. So, knowing what we just discussed about contraband and proceeds, ask yourself, what, if any, criminal offense might Mr. and Mrs. Benavidez have committed here? What money they received, if any, could be considered illegal proceeds? And what, if anything, could be subject to seizure as part of Cinco's ongoing actions?
Yeah, that's a classic scenario, and it really makes you think about how these definitions apply in the real world. Let's break it down. Mr. and Mrs. Benavidez, by knowingly accepting blank checks, participating in the scheme where they knew the pay-to fields was being manipulated, and taking cash for it,
mm-hmm.
they're very likely involved in a money laundering scheme themselves, maybe not the masterminds, but their actions are facilitating Cinco's illicit activities.
Right, they're enabling it.
Exactly. So applying our definitions, the weekly $500 bonus they get from Cinco, that would almost certainly be considered illegal proceeds under CCP 59.017. It was gained directly from Cinco's money laundering scheme, which they were actively, if maybe naively, participating in.
Okay.
Furthermore, the new SUV they bought with that cash, that would also be considered proceeds because it was acquired with funds gained from the commission of an offense.
The SUV too, wow.
And as part of Cinco's larger operation, any other assets directly tied to a scheme, maybe including the funds flowing through the Benavidez's store via those blank checks, could potentially be subject to a seizure. It's a clear illustration of how both the direct, ill-gotten gains and anything purchased with them fall under the definition of proceeds.
So with all this complex legal groundwork and these really broad definitions of what can be seized, you might be wondering, why is something this specific, this intricate, so critical for peace officers to know? It sounds like, you know, a specialized legal field maybe only lawyers should deal with.
That's a fair question, and it's something the legislature has definitively answered. They've explicitly mandated comprehensive training in asset forfeiture for peace officers.
Mandated?
Yes. It's not just an optional course. It's a foundational requirement for officers licensed under Chapter 1701 Occupations Code. Section 1701.253G of the Occupations Code states that as part of the minimum curriculum requirements, the commission shall establish a statewide comprehensive education and training program on asset forfeiture under Chapter 59, Code of Criminal Procedure for all licensed officers.
So it's a must-do, not a nice-to-have. This really highlights that officers aren't just, you know, enforcing laws in the traditional sense, but navigating complex financial and property rights, too.
Exactly, and the mandate goes further. Officers must complete this program within 2 years of being licensed, or by the date they apply for an intermediate proficiency certificate, whichever comes first. And Section 1701.402D specifies that completing this asset forfeiture training is a distinct requirement for getting that intermediate proficiency certificate. The course itself, Course 3255, is typically a solid 2-hour program.
2 hours just on this.
Right. And it's not just about effective law enforcement. It's about empowering officers with the knowledge to wield such a powerful tool responsibly.
That makes sense.
Without this comprehensive training, the potential for procedural errors that could jeopardize legitimate cases, or worse, infringe on civil liberties, would be much higher. They're the first point of contact, often, in these situations. So they absolutely have to know the rules inside and out.
So before any property is even touched, there's a lot of crucial groundwork that has to happen. It's definitely not about acting first and asking questions later, is it?
Precisely. Pre-seizure planning is absolutely vital. Officers need to gather extensive information beforehand. This isn't just about identifying the target property. It's about assessing the viability and legality of a potential seizure.
Hmm.
And just as importantly, mitigating risks and liabilities for the seizing agency. This meticulous planning is critical to make sure the seizure will actually hold up in court.
What kind of information are they looking for during this planning phase? It sounds like it could be a pretty deep dive into someone's entire financial life even before any action is taken.
It absolutely can be. Key planning elements start with basic property ownership. Officers need to determine if the property is community or separate property.
Ah, marital status matters.
Big time. Is it jointly owned by a married couple or belongs solely to one spouse? This is crucial because it directly impacts who can claim an interest in the property later on and what portion might even be subject to seizure. They also investigate if it's leased versus owned and check for any lien-ans or mortgages.
Why lien-ans and mortgages?
Well, think about it. Is the asset even worth seizing if it's so heavily encumbered by debt that its value to the state after paying off the lien holder is minimal?
Ah, so they're doing a kind of cost-benefit analysis before they even move, assessing the equity.
In a way, yes. They'll perform a financial assessment to evaluate the equity over any mortgage. They also conduct a comprehensive risk and liability assessment. What are the potential pitfalls of taking custody of this specific property?
Like what?
Well, this includes factoring in the costs of the seizure itself: storage, maintenance. Seizing, say, a unique classic car or a big commercial fishing vessel might incur significant specialized storage and upkeep costs.
Right, could cost more than it's worth.
Exactly. Those costs could potentially outweigh its forfeited value. Businesses present specific considerations too, like understanding real property leases and any existing liens against inventory, which could affect the state's ability to seize those business assets.
And what if the property is rented out? Does the owner's knowledge or consent matter there?
Absolutely. They need to understand if the property is rented and, critically, if the owner consented to any criminal activity associated with it. This directly ties into potential defenses we'll talk about later, like the innocent owner defense. If a property owner can genuinely prove they had no knowledge of and didn't consent to illicit activity on their rented property, that property might be protected.
Makes sense. What about bank accounts?
For bank accounts, pre-seizure planning involves identifying account numbers, who the signatories are. Officers will often monitor the account to determine the best time to seize funds for maximum impact.
Like when a big deposit is expected.
Perhaps, yeah. Maybe when a large illicit deposit is expected. And they must crucially know whether the account is being used as collateral for a loan, because that impacts the true equity available for seizure.
That's incredibly strategic, thinking about the optimal time for seizure. And I've heard the term commingling thrown around. What does substitute property mean in this context?
Substitute property, or dealing with commingled funds, is a powerful concept. It means that if the original contraband, the specific illicit funds or items directly tied to the crime, can no longer be located. Maybe it's been spent, transferred out of jurisdiction, or has substantially diminished in value. The state may be able to seize other assets that are connected to the criminal activity or were acquired with the proceeds.
So they can go after different assets if the original ones are gone.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
This is how law enforcement can still hit the financial aspect of crime, even if the original funds have been laundered, spent, or hidden. For example, if drug money was used to renovate a house and the money itself is gone, the state could potentially seek forfeiture of the house, or at least the value added by the renovation, as substitute property.
Okay, let's apply this pre-seizure planning to another scenario. Imagine Tiny Tub Motors, a used car business. It's been operating for 10 years on a leased property in a pretty rundown part of town.
Okay.
The lot displays 12 cars, and surveillance shows that twice a week the cars are moved around, new sales prices splashed on the windshields. But the same cars have been on the lot for months.
Suspicious. Low turnover.
Very low. Sales records from the County Tax Assessor Collector's Office show Tiny Tub has sold only 4 cars in the last 12 months.
4 cars in a year.
Yeah. Yet, information shows the manager, Ramon Delfescus, who, by the way, has a prior arrest and conviction for narcotics trafficking where he used a trucking business.
Relevant history.
Right. He deposits $25,000 per week into the business account.
$25,000 a week, selling 4 cars a year.
Exactly. And the business itself is owned by Ramon's 92-year-old mother, Ophelia, who lives in a nursing home and has never even set foot on the property. So, based on what we've learned about pre-seizure planning, let's think. What criminal offense might Mr. Delfescu's be involved in here? What specific actions could be taken against Ramon, against Tiny Tub Motors, against Delfescu's bank account, and importantly, against Ophelia Delfescu's, the owner, on paper?
This scenario, Tiny Tub Motors, is just a prime example of why pre-seizure planning is so vital and it absolutely screams money laundering. Ramon Del Fescue's actions. That huge discrepancy between reported sales and the massive deposits, combined with his prior narcotics trafficking conviction, where he used a business, strongly suggest he's using tiny tub motors to launder illicit funds.
Makes perfect sense.
The specific offense would likely be money laundering, possibly coupled with other charges if the underlying criminal activity, like drug sales, is uncovered.
Okay, so what actions could be taken?
Against Ramon Del Fescue's. Certainly a criminal investigation and likely charges for money laundering. Against Tiny Tub Motors itself, the business could be a target for forfeiture. Its bank accounts, where those $25,000 weekly deposits are happening, those are prime targets for seizure as proceeds of criminal activity.
And the cars on the lot.
The vehicles on the lot, even if they aren't directly contraband themselves, they could potentially be subject to seizure as substitute property if illicit funds have been commingled or invested in the business's inventory.
Okay. And this brings us to Ophelia Del Fescue's, the 92-year-old mother who legally owns the business but seems totally uninvolved. Her property interest makes this really complex, right?
Absolutely complex. For the state to seize the business or any assets truly belonging to her, they would have to overcome that innocent owner defense we mentioned.
Ah, okay.
Investigators would need to determine if Ophelia had any knowledge or, critically, should have reasonably known about her son's illegal activities using her business.
And given her situation?
Well, given her age, her health, living in a nursing home, lack of presence at the business, it would likely be much harder for the state to prove she wasn't an innocent owner.
So the pre-planning would focus there?
Intensely. Pre-seizure planning here would focus intensely on gathering any evidence to either support or, more likely, refute that innocent owner claim regarding Ophelia.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. Once the planning is done, a compelling case seems to be built. How does the actual seizure of property legally occur? Is it always like a dramatic raid we see on TV? Or are there other ways law enforcement can legally take custody of assets?
Well, while dramatic raids certainly capture headlines, the primary and most common legal method for seizure is via a search warrant.
Okay, a warrant.
Yeah, this generally follows the rules from Chapter 18 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. And it's not just any search warrant. It has to be a contraband warrant affidavit that must specifically detail the felony offense committed and clearly show how the described property fits the definition of contraband from CCP 59.01.
So it has to be very specific.
Very specific about the crime and the property's direct connection to it.
But I understand there are exceptions where a warrant isn't strictly necessary. What are those specific circumstances? When can they seize without one?
That's right. There are very specific exceptions, and officers have to know these implicitly to avoid legal challenges down the road. These include situations where the owner, the operator, or their agent knowingly consents to the search and seizure.
Consent is key.
Absolutely.
Oh.
If the seizure happens incident to a search that was already consented to by the owner for another reason, and then the contraband is discovered during that consented search.
Okay.
Also, if the property is already subject to a prior judgment of forfeiture, meaning a court has already legally determined it's forfeitable, in a previous case, it can be seized without a new warrant.
Right. It's already been decided.
Exactly. And importantly, property can be seized incident to a lawful arrest, a lawful search that's already been deemed legal, or a lawful search incident to that arrest. These are all situations where officers are already legally present and then discover the forfeitable property.
So if they're already legally allowed to be somewhere for another reason, like an arrest or a different search, and they find the contraband or proceeds, that counts as a legitimate basis for seizure right then and there.
Exactly. And this leads into some additional warrant exceptions that often fall under the umbrella of exigent circumstances. Essentially, situations requiring immediate action where getting a warrant just isn't feasible or safe.
Like what kind of emergencies?
Well, one common one is plain view. If contraband is clearly visible to an officer while they are lawfully present somewhere. Think about an officer legally in a house, maybe responding to an unrelated call, who sees a pile of drugs or a large amount of cash associated with a known criminal enterprise just sitting out on a table. That can often be seized.
Okay.
Then there are emergency searches or exigencies. These are situations requiring immediate action to prevent harm or the destruction of evidence, for example, if someone is actively trying to flush drugs down a toilet as officers arrive.
Right, gotta act fast.
You do. Also, an officer can seize items within the area within immediate control at the time of arrest.
Yeah.
This is mainly to prevent the arrested person from grabbing a weapon or destroying evidence that's within reach.
Makes sense for safety.
And finally, there's the safety sweep, which allows for a quick and limited search of adjacent rooms. Not for evidence primarily, but to look for hidden dangers or other people who might pose a threat, again, to ensure officer safety.
So even without a warrant, there's always got to be a solid legal justification. What's the overarching standard that applies in all these scenarios, whether they have a warrant or not?
Regardless of the method used, there must always be probable cause for the seizure. And this isn't just a hunch or a vague suspicion. It's legally defined as a reasonable belief that a substantial connection exists between the property to be forfeited and the criminal activity defined by statute.
Probable cause. That's the bedrock.
That's the bedrock legal standard. It's what an officer must be able to articulate clearly and prove if the seizure is ever challenged in court. And a critical warning for officers, something heavily emphasized in training, is that they cannot commit any act that could be seen as inducing a person to waive their rights to their seized property.
Yeah, no coercing them to give it up.
Absolutely not. This falls under official oppression, which is a serious ethical and legal boundary. It carries significant penalties for officers if proven.
Yeah.
And agencies take it very seriously because it completely undermines public trust and jeopardizes the entire case.
Okay. To give you a real sense of what this looks like in practice, we have an example of a seizure warrant affidavit. It details how surveillance, both digital, like monitoring social media, and good old-fashioned visual surveillance, was used to track a target named Jose Manuel Bernal.
Mm-hmm.
The affidavit describes how a confidential informant conducted multiple controlled buys of cocaine, marijuana, psilocybin mushrooms, and THC products directly from Bernal, consistently purchasing felony amounts each time.
Right. And this affidavit really lays out how probable cause is meticulously built piece by piece, demonstrating that reasonable belief standard we talked about.
How so?
Well, Jose Manuel Bernal was clearly identified. His social media activity, where he is apparently actively advertising drug sales, was thoroughly monitored, showing a clear pattern of illicit activity. Multiple controlled buys directly linked him to the alleged criminal enterprise, with confidential informants consistently purchasing felony amounts of various narcotics directly from him. That's strong evidence.
Very direct.
And his vehicle, a gray Dodge Charger, was observed at these controlled buys, further linking that specific asset to the criminal activity. Then, license plate readers tracked that specific vehicle to his business address, solidifying the connection between that particular piece of property, the car, and the alleged criminal activity.
So it connects the person, the activity, and the property.
Exactly. This level of comprehensive detail, from digital surveillance to direct observation, controlled buys, vehicle tracking, it's absolutely crucial for building probable cause and ensuring a lawful seizure and ultimately a successful forfeiture case. Without this detailed documentation, the case would likely fall apart under legal scrutiny later on.
So, okay, the property has been seized. The officer has taken custody based on probable cause, maybe with a warrant, maybe an exception. What are the immediate next steps once that happens? It sounds like there's a strict timeline involved to ensure everything is done by the book and the integrity of the evidence, the property, is maintained.
There is a very precise protocol to follow immediately after a seizure, yes. It's all about maintaining the chain of custody and initiating the forfeiture process correctly. The seizing officer has initial custody and specific duties they absolutely must perform.
Like what?
First, the officer must provide the attorney representing the state, usually the DA's office, with a sworn statement. This statement needs to contain a detailed schedule of all the property seized, often called Schedule A.
Schedule A. Okay.
An acknowledgement that the officer personally seized the property, and a sworn statement listing the specific factual reasons supporting that seizure. Why they believed it was contraband or proceeds. This is the official foundational record of what was taken and why.
And what happens to the physical property itself within that initial time frame? Where does it go?
Within 72 hours of the seizure, that's 3 days, the officer must take one of these crucial actions. They can place the property under seal, which essentially secures it from tampering right where it is, if appropriate.
Uh-huh.
They can remove the property to a place specifically ordered by the court, often a secure impound lot or an evidence facility managed by the agency, or they can require another designated law enforcement agency to take custody of the property and move it to a proper, secure location.
So it has to be secured quickly.
Very quickly. This rapid action ensures the property is protected, accounted for, and its chain of custody is meticulously maintained from the start, preventing any questions later about its integrity.
And what about cash? Is that handled differently?
Yes. Currency has an even more specific and critical requirement. If cash is seized, it must be deposited into an interest-bearing account in the jurisdiction of the prosecuting attorney.
An interest-bearing account? Why?
Well, it prevents physical loss, theft, or accidental commingling of funds with other money. And importantly, it ensures any interest earned on those funds while the case is pending also accrues to the state if the forfeiture is ultimately successful.
This sounds like a lot of meticulous paperwork and very precise timing. How critical is this initial documentation, the sworn statement, Schedule A for the long-term forfeiture process?
Oh, the petition and the supporting affidavit are the absolute backbone of the entire civil forfeiture case. Mm-hmm. They are critical. Think of them as the state's opening argument and the primary piece of evidence against the property itself.
Okay.
If these documents aren't robust, accurate, and legally sound from the get-go, the entire case can easily fail later in court. The petition itself must list all property that was seized, leaving nothing out.
Everything.
Everything. And it must name all known owners or interest holders. That includes lien holders, like a bank with a mortgage on a house, or the specific person who had physical custody of the property when it was seized.
What about spouses? Are they always included?
Interestingly, it does not necessarily include spouses as essential parties automatically. Unless they have a direct, legally recognized interest in that specific property or specific circumstances apply. Marital property laws can be complex, so it's a nuanced point. And as we mentioned, the petition must always be supported by that sworn affidavit.
So that affidavit is essentially the state's detailed probable cause statement specifically for the property. What must it contain and how detailed does it really need to be?
Precisely. The affidavit's primary function is to establish probable cause for forfeiture. It has to demonstrate that reasonable belief that a substantial connection exists between the property to be forfeited and the criminal activity, citing CCP 59.023 again.
Okay.
This requires incredibly specific details. The precise location and date of the seizure, the identity of the property's registered owner, if known, who was physically in possession of the property at the time of seizure, and the identity of all known essential parties to the case.
And the officer writing it.
The officer writing it should really aim to set yourself up as an expert within the document. They need to demonstrate their knowledge, their training, the detailed investigative steps they took to arrive at their conclusion about the property's illicit connection. The seizure must be justified purely on established facts, and circumstantial evidence is not only acceptable, but often necessary to build a compelling case, especially for proceeds.
And what are some of those key facts or factors that really link the property to the criminal activity, especially in, say, drug cases, that an officer would detail in this affidavit?
Good question. The affidavit should clearly lay out the key factors connecting the drugs or other illicit activity to the property. This might include things like its close proximity to drugs or drug paraphernalia found during the search.
Uh-huh.
A positive canine alert for the scent of narcotics on the property, like cash or a car. Any suspicious activity consistent with drug sales or other criminal enterprises observed around the property. The sheer amount of money seized, especially if it lacks a plausible, legitimate source.
Right, the where did this come from question.
Exactly. Any lack of alternative, legitimate sources for the money or the property's acquisition. Or even the unusual storage location of the property, like large amounts of cash hidden oddly. These factors are well established and supported by legal precedent in Texas, which helps solidify the probable cause argument.
Are there any best practices for officers when writing these affidavits to make them as strong and clear as possible for a judge to read?
Yes, absolutely. Ideally, the affidavit should be written by the seizing officer themselves, using first-person language. I observed, I was present, not Officer Smith did this.
More direct.
Much more direct. It conveys personal knowledge and involvement. Officers should avoid hearsay unless it falls under a recognized legal exception, like a statement against interest or an excited utterance.
Keep it simple.
Keep it as simple and clear as possible. Avoid uncommon acronyms and law enforcement jargon that might confuse someone outside the field, including the judge. And, surprisingly to some, the defendant's explanation of where the property came from is not strictly necessary to include in the affidavit itself, unless that explanation is completely implausible and has already been disproven by the investigation. However, that information should definitely be included in the full police report for the prosecutor's benefit and overall context.
That's a lot of meticulous detail, but it sounds like it's all about building a clear, legally sound case right from the start, leaving no room for doubt about the probable cause.
Precisely.
Now, a crucial update I heard about recently involves waivers of interest in seized property. What's the latest on that? Can officers ask people to just sign away their property on the spot?
That's a very important change, reflecting an ongoing effort to protect individual rights and prevent any perception of coercion. Officers are no longer allowed to solicit waivers of interest in seized property.
Not allowed at all.
Not allowed to ask for them, no. This means they cannot ask or encourage someone to give up their claim to seized property at the time of seizure. This is designed to prevent any appearance of undue influence or inducement and ensure that any decision to waive rights is made voluntarily, later, and ideally with full legal understanding, maybe after consulting counsel.
Okay. And what if nobody is even there when the property is seized? Like, it's found abandoned?
Good point. If, for some reason, no one is in possession of the seized property at the time, maybe it was found. Abandoned public notice must still be given. Usually, this means publishing a notice in a newspaper or another public forum in that jurisdiction.
Why?
This ensures that any potential owners, even if they weren't present at the seizure, have a fair opportunity to come forward and assert their interest in the property before it's potentially forfeited.
Okay. So, the property's been seized. All the initial paperwork is meticulously filed. The sworn statements are in. The DA's office is now involved. This brings us to the actual court process. Now, you said earlier, this isn't a criminal trial where guilt or innocence of a person is determined. This is a civil case against the property itself, correct?
That's an excellent distinction, and it's absolutely crucial to understand. The forfeiture proceeding under Article 59.04 of the Code of Criminal Procedure is fundamentally a civil lawsuit.
Civil, not criminal.
Right. This means that civil rules of procedure apply, not criminal ones. And this has significant implications for how the case unfolds. For instance, the burden of proof for the state.
Ah, you mentioned that was lower.
Typically, it needs to be established by a preponderance of evidence. Unlike criminal cases where guilt must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, a very high bar, almost 100% certainty.
Right.
In a civil forfeiture case, the state generally only needs to show its case is more likely than not true. Think of it as just tipping the scales of justice ever so slightly in their favor, maybe 50.1%.
Just over 50%.
Right. Now, it's worth noting, this standard is sometimes debated and could evolve, but currently, that's the general threshold.
That's a huge difference. It really impacts the whole case. What else sets it apart from a criminal trial, particularly for the property owner, the respondent?
Another significant difference is that respondents, the owners of the property, or anyone else with a legal interest in it, are not entitled to appointed counsel.
No public defender.
Generally, no. Unlike criminal cases where indigent defendants often have an attorney appointed to represent them, in a civil forfeiture case, you typically have to hire your own legal representation if you want it.
That could be a major hurdle for some people.
It certainly can be. While the general rules of evidence are largely the same as in criminal trials, including rules about hearsay, another key point is that everything filed in a forfeiture case, from the initial petition to any motions, responses, and final judgments, is a public record.
Public record. Okay. Mm. Who can actually initiate these proceedings and where do they usually take place? Are there strict deadlines for starting the case?
Only a felony prosecutor, typically the district attorney's office or an assistant DA, can file the case. A lower level prosecutor, like for misdemeanors, generally cannot initiate forfeiture.
Okay. DA's office only.
Right. And generally, the case can only be filed in the county where the property was actually seized. This helps keep jurisdiction clear. And yes, there's a critical deadline for the district attorney. They must begin proceedings within 30 days of the date of seizure.
30 days? That's fast.
It is a very firm deadline. And interestingly, if federal agents initially seize property and then turn it over to a local agency, that 30-day time frame actually begins when the local agency physically receives the property, not from the initial federal seizure date. That recognizes the handover process. Huh.
Okay, so how does an interested party, the owner, maybe a lien holder, actually participate or assert their claim in this civil lawsuit?
Yeah.
And can they get their property back while the case is ongoing? It could take months or years, right?
Good questions. To assert an interest, a party must have standing. Basically, they must be the legal owner or the person who was in possession of the property at the time of seizure, and the case has to be filed in the correct county.
Okay, standing.
Once the DA filed the petition, a constable is responsible for formally serving all known parties with an interest in the property. They get served with a civil citation and a copy of the petition. This is the official evidence of lawsuit, and formally notifies them of the proceedings and the deadline to respond.
And getting the property back while it's pending.
There is a mechanism. An interested party may be able to post a replevy bond.
Replevy bond?
Yes. they have to post a bond with sufficient surety, usually from a bonding company, that's equal to or greater than the appraised value of the seized property. If they could do that, they could regain possession of their property while the case proceeds through court.
So you can get your property back, but you have to put up a bond potentially equal to its entire value. That sounds like a significant financial commitment, maybe impossible for many.
Exactly. It's a way for property owners to avoid the immediate hardship of losing access to their assets, especially if it's something crucial like a work vehicle. But it does require substantial financial liquidity up front.
What happens if they don't respond or show up?
If an interested party fails to appear for a court hearing or simply doesn't file a formal answer to the petition within the legal time frame, a default judgment can be entered against them.
Default judgment, meaning?
Meaning they automatically forfeit their claim to the property without a trial on the merits. Game over for their claim. There is a specific, fairly short 30-day appeal period per docket after a default judgment is entered. But missing that initial response can be absolutely devastating to their chances.
Wow. And you mentioned official oppression earlier. Does that concern still apply during the court phase?
Absolutely. Just like in the seizure phase, the concern for official oppression abusing state power remains relevant throughout the court proceedings. It's a powerful tool the state is wielding, and it must be exercised strictly within legal and ethical boundaries at every stage.
Beyond the main court proceedings, are there other legal avenues or dynamics that commonly come into play in these cases? It sounds like there could be a lot of behind-the-scenes legal maneuvering, like in any lawsuit.
Yes, exactly. Like any civil litigation, forfeiture cases involve various stages of discovery and potential resolutions. Parties will engage in civil discovery to gather evidence from each other.
Discovery? What does that involve?
It includes things like interrogatories. These are formal written questions sent from one party to the other, which must be answered under oath. They're used to gather specific information and facts.
Okay.
And then there are depositions, which are out-of-court sworn testimonies taken from witnesses or parties. Attorneys get to ask questions directly, and the testimony is recorded by a court reporter.
Like questioning someone before trial.
Precisely. These are crucial tools for gathering detailed information, locking down testimony, understanding the opponent's case, and building a stronger case for either side.
So it's all about gathering facts and evidence, much like other lawsuits. And I assume settlement is often an option, perhaps to avoid a lengthy, expensive trial.
Absolutely. Settlement offers and negotiations are very common in forfeiture cases. Many, perhaps even most cases, are resolved through agreements reached between the state and the property owner without the need for a full trial.
Why settle?
Well, it can save both parties significant time, legal expenses, and the uncertainty of a trial outcome. But if no settlement is reached, the case does proceed to trial.
Are there other dynamics maybe between different agencies involved?
Yes, that's another layer. There are often local agreements, sometimes called interlocal agreements or MOUs between different law enforcement agencies or jurisdictions. These agreements dictate how they'll cooperate on forfeiture cases and, importantly, how any forfeited assets or funds will be shared between them.
Sharing the proceeds.
Exactly. Yeah. Also, there's a process called federal adoption. This is where a seizure initially made by state or local officers is adopted by a federal agency like the DEA or FBI.
Why would they do that?
It allows the case to proceed under federal forfeiture law, which can sometimes have different rules, procedures, or distribution mechanisms for the forfeited assets. Depending on the case specifics, federal adoption might offer perceived advantages to law enforcement, though it's also sometimes controversial.
Okay. If we connect all this back to the bigger picture, why is this whole complex system even a thing? What's the scale of the problem asset forfeiture is trying to address? It seems like an incredibly resource-intensive process for law enforcement and the courts.
It is indeed resource-intensive, no doubt. But it's designed specifically to tackle the immense financial gains generated by criminal activity, particularly large-scale drug trafficking, organized crime, and major fraud operations.
How immense are we talking?
Well, for context, reports from back in 2005 estimated that just the drug profits moving through the U.S. financial system alone were as high as $100 billion a year.
$100 billion? Just drug money in the U.S.?
Yes. And when you look at the entire illicit drug trade globally, it was estimated back then to be worth a staggering $400 billion a year.
$400 billion. Globally.
Globally. And to put that in perspective, that figure represented about 8% of all international trade worldwide at the time.
8% of all trade. Wow. That truly is a staggering amount of money. That really puts the scale of this problem and the reason for a tool like forfeiture into incredible perspective. Does that immense figure sometimes create, you know, pressure or maybe motivation for agencies to pursue forfeiture more aggressively, maybe seeing it as a funding source?
That's a fair point, and it's often part of the debate surrounding forfeiture. The sheer scale of illicit funds certainly highlights the significant economic motivation behind forfeiture.
Yeah.
The idea is that by disrupting these massive financial flows, law enforcement can cripple criminal organizations more effectively than just arresting low-level individuals.
Hitting the financial engine.
It's a direct assault on the economic engine of crime. Now, while the funds generated from forfeiture are legally meant to be reinvested into law enforcement purposes, the potential for agencies to recover investigation costs or even supplement tight budgets can, realistically, be a factor. And that's precisely why there are such strict rules and oversight mechanisms governing how these funds can actually be used, to prevent it from becoming primarily a revenue-generating tool rather than a crime-fighting one.
Okay. This sounds like an incredibly powerful tool for the state, almost overwhelmingly so at times. But surely there have to be ways for property owners to defend their assets against forfeiture. It can't just be a one-sided street where property is automatically lost once seized, right?
Absolutely not. There are critical defenses, both statutory, meaning they're specifically written into the law, and non-statutory defenses that have developed through case law, that a property owner or another interest holder can raise to challenge a forfeiture action. Understanding these is absolutely vital for anyone whose property might be targeted.
Okay, what's the main one?
The most paramount of the statutory defenses, found right there in Article 59.02 of the Code of Criminal Procedure, is the innocent owner defense. This is a crucial protection built into the system.
The innocent owner defense. Okay, that sounds incredibly important. How exactly does that work? What does a property owner need to prove to successfully use that defense?
It's multifaceted. It has a couple of main branches. For the first branch of this defense to apply, the owner must prove two things. First, that they acquired their interest in the property before the illegal act giving rise to forfeiture occurred.
Okay, before the crime.
And the second, that they did not know or should not reasonably have known about the criminal act or omission that led to the forfeiture, or that it was likely to occur at or before the time they acquired their interest.
So ignorance, but reasonable ignorance.
Exactly. It's about proving a genuine lack of knowledge or at least no reasonable basis to suspect criminal activity involving their property when they first got involved with it.
And what if they acquired the property after the criminal act had already happened? Maybe they bought a car used in a crime without knowing. Is there still an innocent owner path?
Yes, there's an alternative branch for that situation. If they acquired the interest after the act, the owner must prove they were without reasonable cause to believe the property was contraband at the time they acquired it. This is key. They did not purposefully avoid learning that the property was contraband.
Ah, the willful blindness point again. Can't just stick your head in the sand.
Precisely. You can't deliberately ignore obvious red flags suggesting the property's illicit connection just to claim ignorance later. Another important statutory defense is use without effective consent.
What does that mean?
This applies if the property was used or intended to be used in the crime without the effective consent of the owner. The classic example is if the property was stolen from the owner and then used in a crime. The owner didn't consent to that use.
Right, that makes sense. What about spouses? Assets are often shared, especially in community property states like Texas. Is there a general spousal defense?
Interestingly, no. There is no general spousal defense under the law that automatically protects marital property from forfeiture just because it's jointly owned. And the fact that property is community property is not a defense in itself against forfeiture if it was used in or derived from crime.
So community property doesn't shield it?
Not inherently, no. However, there is a very specific and probably quite narrow family violence defense. A spouse can argue that because of documented family violence perpetrated against them, they were effectively unable to prevent their spouse from committing the criminal act that led to the forfeiture.
A very specific circumstance.
Very specific, and requires proof of the violence and its impact on their ability to intervene.
Okay. Now, what if the related criminal charges against the property owner are dismissed? Or what if they go to trial and are found not guilty? Does that automatically mean they get their property back in the separate civil forfeiture case?
That's a really important point. If the related criminal charges are dismissed, or if the defendant is acquitted, found not guilty, in the criminal trial, this raises a legal presumption that the property should not be forfeited.
A presumption again.
Yes, it's a strong legal presumption. It significantly strengthens the owner's case in the civil forfeiture lawsuit and makes it much harder for the state to meet its burden of proving the property should be forfeited by a preponderance of the evidence.
But it's not an automatic win for the property owner.
Correct. It's a strong presumption, but given the different standards of proof, beyond a reasonable doubt versus preponderance of evidence, and the civil nature of forfeiture against the property, not the person, it's not an absolute automatic bar to forfeiture in every single conceivable circumstance, although practically, it often leads to the return of the property.
Okay. Beyond these defenses written in the statute, are there other common arguments property owners use to fight back, maybe defenses based on case law?
Yes, there are several non-statutory defenses that are often raised. One sometimes comes up involving alleged controlled substance analogs.
Analogs, like substances that mimic illegal drugs.
Exactly. If the state claims a substance is an analog of a controlled substance, meaning it chemically resembles or has similar effects to an illegal drug but isn't explicitly listed in the law, the defense can challenge whether it truly meets the legal definition of an analog. The state, interestingly, only needs to show the substance is an analog by either its chemical structure or its pharmacological effect. Not necessarily both.
Okay. What else?
Another interesting point is homestead protection. In Texas, the law generally protects a person's primary residence, their homestead, from being seized by creditors. However, its applicability in forfeiture cases is actually not settled law in Texas.
Not settled, so it's debatable.
Yes. It's an area of ongoing legal debate and interpretation. Whether homestead protection can shield a primary residence from forfeiture due to criminal activity can vary depending on the specific facts of the case and the court hearing it. It's not a guaranteed defense.
And what about proving where the money or assets actually came from? I imagine that's a very common and potentially powerful defense in cases involving seized cash or other property.
It absolutely is. Arguing a legitimate source of income is perhaps one of the most common and, if proven, very powerful defenses. The owner has the burden to establish convincingly that the seized property or funds came from a legitimate source, entirely unrelated to any criminal activity.
How do they prove that?
This typically requires extensive discovery before trial to gather and present supporting evidence. We're talking detailed financial records, proof of when, where, and how checks were negotiated, evidence of funds being deposited into specific accounts, along with the history of those accounts, documentation of when funds were converted to cash, and crucially, clear, verifiable proof of legitimate employment, business revenue, inheritance, gifts, or other documented legal income sources that explain the assets.
So a strong paper trail is essential.
Absolutely essential. Without that kind of detailed financial paper trail, it becomes very difficult to counteract the state's claim that the assets must be proceeds of crime, especially if there's a large discrepancy between known legitimate income and the value of the asset seized.
Are there any other important legal issues that play out differently in forfeiture cases compared to typical criminal proceedings? Things that could catch an unsuspecting property owner off guard?
Yes, there are two major ones that are really important to understand. First, the suppression of evidence in the criminal case. Let's say evidence was thrown out of the criminal trial because the police obtained it illegally, violating the Fourth Amendment.
Right, fruit of the poisonous tree.
Exactly. That suppression ruling in the criminal case should have no effect on the separate civil forfeiture case.
Wait, really? They can still use illegally obtained evidence in the forfeiture case?
Generally, yes. Different legal rules and standards, particularly the exclusionary rule, apply differently in civil proceedings compared to criminal trials. So evidence deemed inadmissible in a criminal trial might still be perfectly admissible and used against the property in the forfeiture case. That's a huge difference.
Wow, that is huge. What's the second one?
The second one, and this can be a real trap for defendants involved in both criminal and forfeiture cases, concerns the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination.
Pleading the Fifth.
Right. In a criminal trial, the prosecutor cannot comment on a defendant's decision to plead the Fifth. And the jury can't be told to infer guilt from their silence.
Correct.
However, in the civil forfeiture case, the invocation of the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination by the defendant can be used against them.
How so?
The fact that they invoke the right can be used as a comment in court, and the judge or jury can draw an adverse inference from their silence. Basically, the court in the civil case can interpret their refusal to answer questions about the source of the property as an indication that they cannot provide a legitimate explanation.
So pleading the fifth in the forfeiture case can actually hurt you.
It absolutely can. It's a crucial distinction and a very powerful tool for the state's attorneys in forfeiture proceedings, putting defendants in a very difficult strategic position if they're facing parallel criminal charges.
Okay, let's apply these defenses, particularly proceeds and innocent owner, to our earlier scenario about Martin Jenkins. He's the state commercial vehicle inspector, salary $51,000. His wife makes about $8,000 part-time as a crossing guard, combined income under $60,000.
Right.
Yet he's routinely spending $2,000 a week on a stripper, been doing that for over a year, lives in a $400,000 home, owns matching Land Rovers for himself and his wife, matching motorcycles, lavish furnishings, and that huge 100-weapon gun collection, all paid for in cash. The investigation links him to a sophisticated narcotics smuggling operation where his role is basically to distract other inspectors. So thinking about proceeds and the innocent owner defense, what criminal offense could Jenkins himself be charged with? Could his wife be charged criminally? And crucially, to what extent could her assets be affected by forfeiture? What actions could be taken on all that property they've accumulated?
Right. The Martin Jenkins scenario is just a textbook example of proceeds derived from criminal activity, especially money laundering, given that massive glaring discrepancy between his legitimate income and his incredibly lavish cash-funded lifestyle.
Totally unsustainable on their salaries.
Completely. Jenkins could certainly be charged with money laundering for taking illicit funds and trying to make them appear legitimate through these large cash purchases. Depending on his specific role in the smuggling operation, he could also face charges like engaging in organized criminal activity or drug conspiracy.
Okay. And his wife? Could she face criminal charges too?
Whether his wife could be charged criminally would depend entirely on her level of direct involvement or proven knowledge of the criminal enterprise. Did she actively participate? Did she know what he was doing? That's a criminal investigation question.
But what about her assets? The Land Rover in her name, her share of the house. Could those be forfeited even if she isn't charged criminally?
That's where the innocent owner defense becomes absolutely critical for her. Her ability to protect her assets, like her Land Rover, her interest in the $400,000 home, would hinge entirely on whether she knew or should have reasonably known about the illegal source of their extravagant lifestyle.
Could she plausibly not know?
That's the million-dollar question for the court. If she was truly unaware, with absolutely no reasonable cause to suspect where all this cash was coming from, maybe her interest could be protected. But if there's evidence suggesting she willfully ignored blindingly obvious financial red flags, like a combined income under $60,000, somehow supporting a $400,000 home, matching luxury vehicles, matching motorcycles, a massive gun collection, and a $2,000 weekly stripper habit, all paid in cash, she would likely have a very, very difficult time convincing a court she was a truly innocent owner who had no reason to be suspicious.
The sheer volume makes it hard to believe she wouldn't suspect something.
Exactly. The sheer volume of cash-paid assets would raise significant questions about willful blindness. As for the actions on the property, the vast amount accumulated by Jenkins and his wife, the home, both Land Rovers, both motorcycles, the gun collection, the lavish furnishings, would all be potential targets for seizure as proceeds of the criminal enterprise.
All of it?
Potentially, yes. The state would argue these were acquired either directly or indirectly, with illicit funds derived from his role in the smuggling operation. And without proof of a legitimate income source capable of covering such massive expenditures, the burden would shift heavily onto Jenkins and his wife to prove otherwise, which seems almost impossible in this scenario. It perfectly illustrates how asset forfeiture aims to strip away all the fruits of criminal activity, even when those fruits have been integrated into what looks like, on the surface, legitimate life.
Okay. So after all the legal battles, the defenses, the procedures, and assuming the state has successfully forfeited property, you might wonder, what's the ultimate purpose? Where do these seized assets, the cash, the cars, the houses, actually end up? Is it just a free-for-all for law enforcement agencies to spend however they want?
That's a really important question, and accountability is critical here. The use of forfeited funds is strictly governed by state law and also often by specific interlocal agreements between the agencies involved. It's definitely not a blank check. There are very clear guidelines and restrictions on where this money can go, and it's all designed to serve specific public safety purposes, reinforcing that remedial, not punitive nature of forfeiture we talked about at the start.
So what are the approved uses? How can law enforcement agencies and prosecutors legitimately spend this money that's been taken from criminal enterprises?
The funds must be spent on a law enforcement purpose. That term is specifically defined in the law, CCP 59.06 D10 and D3, as an activity of a law enforcement agency that's related to the criminal and civil enforcement of state laws.
Okay, law enforcement purpose.
They can also be used for an official purpose of an attorney's office, which relates directly to the preservation, enforcement, or administration of state laws, basically, funding the legal side of fighting crime.
Can you give us some specific, tangible examples of what those purposes actually entail? Like, where does this money really go in practice?
Certainly. Approved uses include purchasing essential equipment and supplies for law enforcement, thick new patrol cars, bulletproof vests, surveillance gear, maybe computer forensic tools, body cameras.
Okay, equipment.
It can cover investigative and training-related travel expenses for officers, sending them to specialized courses on narcotics investigations, cybercrime, financial crimes, or new investigative techniques.
Training. Makes sense.
Funds can also support community crime prevention programs,
right,
or drug treatment programs. They can cover facility costs related to law enforcement buildings, maintenance, utilities, maybe even construction in some cases, witness-related costs, like protection or relocation for crucial witnesses in major cases. Even audit costs, specifically related to the forfeiture program itself, to ensure financial transparency.
Right.
And for the prosecutors, funds can cover legal fees associated with forfeiture litigation, state bar dues for the attorneys, and dues for legal associations they belong to. The overarching idea is that the money taken from crime is directly reinvested back into fighting crime and maintaining the justice system infrastructure needed to do that. It's intended to be a self-sustaining mechanism in that sense.
Okay, that makes sense. It's supposed to be a kind of closed loop, taking from crime to fight crime more effectively. But just as important, what are the prohibited uses? Where can this money absolutely not go? These restrictions seem crucial for preventing misuse or the appearance of misuse.
They're absolutely crucial for preventing abuse and maintaining public trust. The law, specifically CCP 59.06 D-1, lays out clear prohibitions. Forfeited funds cannot be used for political campaign donations under any circumstances.
Okay, definite no-no.
Cannot be donated to most other entities, except as specifically provided by other laws. This prevents the funds from being diverted to, say, unrelated non-governmental organizations or private ventures without explicit legal authorization.
So no using forfeiture funds to get reelected or to fund some personal pet project outside of strict law enforcement or prosecutorial functions.
Correct. Furthermore, the funds cannot be used for training, for any member of the judiciary judges can't benefit directly from these funds for their training. Travel expenses for training that would violate generally applicable restrictions already established by the governing body, like a county commissioner's court or city council, are also strictly prohibited.
Okay. Any other surprising prohibitions?
Well, perhaps surprisingly to some, these funds specifically cannot be used to purchase alcoholic beverages. That's a very clear line drawn in the statute.
No funding the office party with forfeiture money.
Definitely not. Additionally, any expenditure that hasn't been approved by the commissioner's court or the governing body of the municipality is prohibited, particularly if the head of the law enforcement agency, like the sheriff or police chief, or the attorney representing the state, like the DA, holds an elective office. This provides an extra layer of oversight and public accountability for elected officials handling these funds.
That's a key check and balance.
It is. And finally, and this is significant, these funds generally cannot be used for increasing the salaries of individual law enforcement personnel or attorneys.
Cannot be used for raises.
Unless those salary increases are specifically approved by the governing body through the normal public budgetary process. This ensures salary decisions are part of transparent collective bargaining or public approval processes, not just an arbitrary use of discretionary forfeiture funds by a department head.
So what does this all boil down to? It's clearly designed to prevent abuse, ensure the funds are reinvested directly back into the public safety system, but with really clear checks and balances to prevent them from becoming some kind of unaccountable slush fund or being used for personal or political gain. The intent seems to be enhancing capacity, not creating independent funding streams for individual enrichment or bypassing public budget oversight.
Precisely. The strict guidelines are there to ensure accountability and to reinforce that remedial, not punitive, core philosophy of forfeiture. They ensure the funds are used, theoretically, for their intended purpose, to enhance law enforcement capabilities, upgrade equipment, provide essential training, and support the legal system in fighting criminal enterprises, rather than becoming a source of unmonitored discretionary spending or creating perverse incentives. It's always going to be a delicate balance to strike in practice.
Well, we've certainly taken a deep dive into asset forfeiture today. We've gone from its core philosophy of, you know, depriving criminals of their ill-gotten gains to the really meticulous legal processes involved. We've covered everything from that intensive pre-seizure planning and the various search and seizure methods, both with and without warrants, to the complex post-seizure documentation like Schedule A and the affidavits, and then the whole civil forfeiture proceedings in court. We've also explored the critical defenses available to property owners, like that crucial innocent owner defense. And finally, the strict rules governing where forfeited funds can and importantly cannot go.
And hopefully you now have a much stronger foundational understanding of what is undeniably a powerful and often debated aspect of modern law enforcement. Our goal was really to give you that aha moment of clarity on a complex subject, arming you with knowledge that goes far beyond the headlines and allows you to truly teach yourself the practical realities and legal nuances of asset forfeiture.
Absolutely. And as we wrap up this deep dive, consider this final provocative thought to mull over. Given the truly immense financial scale of the illicit activities that asset forfeiture aims to combat, those hundreds of billions of dollars globally, and the significant power it grants to the state, how might evolving technologies think about new forms of digital assets like NFTs or the increasing adoption of cryptocurrency, which often operates outside traditional banking systems? How might these present both new challenges and maybe new opportunities for this complex legal tool in the future? Where does forfeiture go in a world of blockchain and decentralized finance?